Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Of General Michael Hayden to lead the CIA, all of the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee are taking part in a closed-doors briefing about the controversial surveillance activities that Hayden began while he led the NSA. Democrats have been pressing for months for the entire committee to be briefed about the NSA programs, which include wiretapping the international communications of terrorists and suspects in the U.S., and reportedly collecting domestic phone call records, all without court warrants. Verizon and Bell South are now denying they provide the domestic phone call information to the government, as first reported in USA Today. Well, joining us with more on all of this is Paul Taylor, correspondent for the Financial Times. And Paul, first of all, what reason has the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee given for needing to have this full committee briefing today? Because, you know, for so long, 5 months, Republican leaders had resisted a full briefing.
Yeah, basically they've said that they can't make an informed decision on the Hayden appointment without hearing full details of the supposed NSA surveillance program.
But, you know, as you well know, other lawmakers are saying that if senators are briefed today on that surveillance, and the current head of the NSA is at the briefing, and they're told the information that they hear today is classified, then they won't be able to raise it in questions to General Hayden tomorrow. So it sort of trumps that.
It does indeed. It's all rather confusing. I think that certainly some of the Democrats are likely on both the House and Senate intelligence committees are likely to try and find ways around that without breaking the law themselves.
Right. Well,
but we don't quite know how they're going to do that.
Right. Well, to remind ourselves, President Bush signed an executive order that he says authorizes the international eavesdropping program. His critics disagree. But to the domestic program, Verizon is denying the story that USA Today first reported about the collecting of phone records. Bell South denied the reports on Monday. But is there any way that the government can be getting that information without, you know, Verizon or Bell South actually giving it to them?
Well, I think there are several questions, several specific questions there. One is that the denials of the phone companies themselves are clearly very carefully worded. And in both cases, they actually say, they begin their statements by saying, we can't talk about contacts with the NSA.
Right.
So it may be that the language of the denials is important in the interpretation of what they're actually saying. And Verizon, for example, talked about having no contracts with the NSA, which, of course, is the foundation of the USA Today story, that they said that the phone companies had agreed to contracts with the NSA. Well, it may just be that they've been handing over the information without specifically having a contract. There are other possibilities, but since neither the NSA nor the phone companies are talking or answering questions about this, we just don't know the nature of the contact or the nature of any information that might have been handed over. There are other ways that the NSA could get this information, and there's a lawsuit that the Electronic Frontier Foundation in California, which is a privacy group, privacy protection group.
Right. They're claiming that a technician for AT&T says that, in fact, the government did send people in to set up equipment. And USA Today is pointing out today that Verizon's statement doesn't mention MCI, which is their long-distance
right.
carrier. So, in fact,
right.
this information could be going through another carrier.
Exactly. MCI, of course, was acquired by Verizon earlier this year, and Verizon actually, in its first statement about this affair, actually said it was seeking to extend or was looking to extend its privacy policies to MCI, which sort of left open the question about what MCI had been
right.
doing before.
And that it hadn't done it yet. Paul Taylor,
right.
correspondent for the Financial Times, will hear much more about all of this in the coming days. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we're going to take a few minutes for a grandfather's thoughts on his grandson's autism.
Oh, Sam, what I would give to be able to look inside your mind, and I would love for you to know its nature also. What if you could step outside, look at your inner workings, and say to me, isn't it interesting in there? Someday, perhaps, you'll do just that.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb reading from his new book, Letters to Sam, A Grandfather's Lessons on Love, Loss, and the Gifts of Life. Sam is Dan Gottlieb's 5-year-old grandson, and by all accounts they're quite a pair, kindred spirits, as Dan says. Sam was diagnosed with pervasive developmental disability, a form of autism, shortly after his first birthday. Dan is a quadriplegic, the result of a terrible car accident 25 years ago that paralyzed him from the neck down. Dan's goal is to relay to his grandson lessons on tolerating his own differentness, understanding bullies, love, and loss. And Dan Gottlieb joins us now from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia with more. Welcome.
Robin, thank you. It's so nice to be with you.
Well, and as listeners in Pennsylvania know, you are also host of the very popular radio program Voices in the Family. It's on WHYY on Mondays, the only day we don't air there because there would be a minor revolt if people could not hear Dan Gottlieb. And I'm just wondering, you know, here you have given advice to other people, or at least helped, tried to help other people for 20 years. When this came up in your own family, it says your daughter's son, did you know anything about autism?
I knew enough to know that Sam had autism when he stopped babbling and apparently stopped listening.
Yeah.
So I knew enough to know that he had autism.
In fact, you saw some signs and you were almost afraid to tell your daughter.
I was. I mean, you struggle with that. You know, I'm both a father and a psychologist. And what breaks my heart is Debbie, Sam's mother, grew up with disability. She was 5 years old when I became a quadriplegic. And I thought, you know, she had this baby. She's free now, and here it comes again, another disability. And I was just heartsick. I was more heartsick about Debbie than I was about Sam.
Well, why is that? Why wasn't the heartsickness for Sam as well?
Well, I'll tell you why. There was something I knew about Sam. He was about 8 months old, and Sam wasn't comfortable with me. I guess it was the wheelchair or whatever. He just wasn't comfortable with me, wouldn't come near me. And then when he was 8 months old, my dad died. And we were at the funeral, graveside, and I was sitting there crying. And all Sam wanted to do was be on my lap. And he insisted in his own way. And Debbie, his mom, put him on my lap, and he was very quiet. He just let me hold him and love him. And in his way, he cared for me. And at that point, by the way, that's all he wants now when we're together. But at that point, I knew something of the nature of this child's heart.
Well, tell us a little bit about the world that he lives in. And by the way, you are not an expert on autism, but in the way many family members have to become one, you have as well. You've done a lot of research into it. Just remind us, there is an autism spectrum. Where does Sam fall on that spectrum?
Well, there's good news and bad news here. The good news is he's high-functioning. He's quite high-functioning. He didn't speak for the first 3 years of his life. He used sign language, and now he speaks constantly. You could spend a day with him, and you couldn't tell. He's relational. He makes eye contact. As I said, he's a compassionate and caring boy, which typically doesn't happen with autistic children. On the other hand, his social skills are fairly poor, so that when he's with his peers, he doesn't quite know how to get in there and interact. He's also easily anxious, and if his routine changes, even in the slightest, he can get pretty upset. So if he's not going to have a typical day, his mom has to print out picture cards, and which will go through the day step by step exactly the way it'll be and what Sam can expect so that he'll be able to tolerate it.
What exactly is autism that we know?
Well, what we know is it's a disease of the brain. We don't know what causes it, but we do know it affects one's social skills, one's relational skills, and it affects all of one's senses so that some kids with autism, certain sounds will be terribly irritating to them. Certain sensations will also be irritating to them.
In fact, on your program, Voices in the Family, you spoke to a young autistic man who'd been treated and was doing quite well, but you asked him to remember what it was like when he was much younger and had some of these sensory problems. Let's listen.
Well, when people even whispered to me, it sounded like they were yelling at me. I could hear trucks from down the road. I could hear planes inside the house from the basement because my hearing was so super sensitive. I could hear anything, and I couldn't process it, so it was just overload.
What about visually?
It was extremely hard to see because it was just fuzzy and different colors. It was very hard. I couldn't tell that a wall was a wall, and, you know, when you see a wall and a door, it's just like they blended in. You couldn't tell the difference between the two.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb speaking to a young man who's older now, looking back on being autistic as a child. And Dan, you write about your grandson having some of those same issues. What struck me, for instance, as you are telling him in your letters to him, that you remember a time when his mom tried to put an amusement park ride bar down over his legs, and he just couldn't stand the touch.
Yeah, and we didn't know what it was. The point I wanted to make to him, though, in the larger sense, is all of us have issues like this. His issues are under the autism spectrum, and mine are under the quadriplegia spectrum. But we all have issues that make us, at some point in our lives, feel different from everyone else.
Well, in fact,
and the question is how we cope with it.
Well, in fact, you tell a story about how when you're first in the hospital, and here you are, you know, your neck crushed in this terrible car accident, and you're lying there, and you hear someone down the hallway say, that quad in room 301, refer to you as a quad.
Yeah, and my first reaction was, you know, just yesterday I was known as Dr. Gottlieb in some circles, and Dan in others, and Daddy in others, and now I'm reduced to that quad. And my fear is that, you know, one day Sam's going to be referred to as that autistic kid. And I have learned over the course of my career about these labels. Sam has a brain disorder known as autism, but look what he did at my dad's funeral. Mm. He's got a great soul. Yeah, I'm a quadriplegic, but I'm so much more than that. I am no more or less human than anyone else around me.
But I'm wondering, how did you balance that, Dan, this idea of trying to relay to Sam that autism doesn't define him, but also caution him that, in fact, it's going to present hurdles for him?
You know, it's a fact of life that he will discover, I have discovered, how to navigate the world where we fit in a way, and in some ways, we just don't fit.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb, his new book is called Letters to Sam, A Grandfather's Lessons on Love, Loss, and the Gifts of Life. When we come back, we'll hear more about what it feels like to be autistic and hear techniques Dan used to reach Sam. So that's after a break. Don't forget later in the program why The Economist magazine is calling Bush and Blair the axis of feeble. That's still ahead. Much more ahead here and now. He's a quadriplegic. He's the grandfather of an autistic boy named Sam. But Dan is also host of the radio program Voices in the Family on WHYY in Philadelphia. And on that program, he spoke with a young man about what it felt like to be a child with autism. Let's listen to a little more of that.
Remember what it was like being you, like 3, 4, 5 years old?
Well, kindergarten, I was still kind of in my own world. I like doing things on my own. I couldn't handle much human interaction. I didn't quite know how to react to some of the kids around me, and I was still very touch sensitive. My hearing was still very intense.
What was it like when someone touched you?
It was excruciatingly painful.
Did it feel like a knife or sandpaper?
Yeah, a knife. It was that bad, and like a severe electrical shock.
Did you understand other people? Could you tell when people were trying to help you or when people were scared of you or making fun of you?
It was hard to tell. You know, when people moved from the room or anything moved, it had to be where it was or I couldn't process it.
What do you mean couldn't process it?
It's hard to explain. It would feel like someone took something out of place and I would lose my balance on everything around me and just was off. And I had to reprocess everything all over again.
An interview from Dan Gottlieb's Voices in the Family program on WHYY. And Dan, what did you and your daughter's family do to help your grandson, Sam, with his autism? What worked?
Early on, we used some of Stanley Greenspan's ideas about floor time. What's most effective for Sam is speech therapy. He's been in speech therapy up to 3 times a week. He's down now to 2x a week. He's mainstreamed in a school. He gets pulled out for special therapies, but mainstreaming him helps a great deal. But again, it depends on where a child is on the spectrum, what's most effective.
And what do you mean by floor time?
Floor time is literally when parents get on the floor with an infant and engage them constantly so that these children can't get lost inside their heads. Floor time enables, forces the child to make decisions, to take control of social situations. And it's really been helpful for so many children. My main concern, because of his autism, because he's different, is that people will look at him differently, talk to him differently, or not look at him at all. And I that's terribly painful. And if we take inside their truths to become our truths, then we're in trouble. And what he needs to learn, the lesson I've learned and need to relearn, is that when people don't look at us, it's because of their anxiety. We represent their nightmare. We represent dependency and vulnerability and lack of clarity in our thinking. This is most people's nightmare there, but for the grace of God, they don't like to make eye contact with their own nightmare, and we embody it. In that moment, they're suffering probably more than we are.
You tell another story about your wheelchair wheel getting stuck in a gopher hole on the front lawn, and you just start weeping. I mean, you're brutally honest. Delve deeply into some very adult stories, including your, sounds like just a horrific divorce. Your wife left you, then was diagnosed with MS and died. Did you ever think, maybe this is too much to impart to a young person? Maybe, you know, most people don't talk that much about, you know, what was going on between the adults.
No, I didn't think that way. I think that all grandparents, all adults over the age of 40 or 50 ought to begin writing a book like this to their progeny. When I give lectures to audiences, to adults, I ask them, how many of you knew your parents' expectations and values? And everybody raises their hands. And I say, how many of you knew your parents' hearts, knew their internal experience, their demons, their wishes, their accomplishments, and their fears? And very few people raise their hands. And I say, how many of you would have liked to? How many of you feel you'd be better people if you had known that? And they all raise their hands. That's what our children want. They want to know what's real.
What's your hope? You've written the book. He's 5 now. Do you know now even whether or not he'll be able to read this? Do you, you know, can you tell now?
I'm confident that he'll be able to read. Whether he understands, I don't know. I know he'll be able to feel the love, the devotion in the book that he'll pick up. My wish for the book, it's partly a love story. Huh. It's partly a memoir. But in the deepest sense, it's really my prayer for the world. I want the world Sam lives in, grows up in, to be softer than the world I live in today. I want more people to look at one another in the eye and see their humanity than we have today.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb, psychologist and host of the weekly radio program Voices in the Family. It airs on WHYY in Philadelphia every Monday at noon. His new book is called Letters to Sam, A Grandfather's Lessons on Love, Loss, and the Gifts of Life. Royalties from the book sales will benefit Cure Autism Now and other children's health organizations. Dr. Dan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
All right, we have this note about a news story we've been following on Here and Now. The U.S. Senate voted unanimously today to bar illegal immigrants convicted of a felony or three misdemeanors from a chance at remaining in the U.S. The vote pushes forward a broader immigration bill that would embody President Bush's guest worker program, granting legal status to millions of illegal immigrants and putting many of them on a path toward citizenship. Critics are still trying to reshape that bill and are pushing for things such as building more fences along the 2,000-mile border with Mexico. The Senate vote came today as thousands of immigration advocates poured into Washington to lobby lawmakers. And as Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said, using thousands of National Guard troops to secure the border with Mexico will not detract from missions at home and abroad. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Museum of Science.
A picture of President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The huge headline reads, Axis of Feeble, the closing of the Bush-Blair era. The magazine focuses on the relationship between the two world leaders, how their partnership shaped world events since 9/11, and what the future holds, including who might become Bush's next confidant when his close ally, Tony Blair, leaves 10 Downing next summer. Adrian Wooldridge is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. He joins us to talk more about the Bush-Blair connection, about to be disconnected. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's an unflattering headline, but make your case, especially that, as you say, that these soaring hawks are now lame ducks. We're all aware of President Bush's poll numbers here in the U.S., but how is Tony Blair faring?
Exactly the same. Last week we had a poll in Great Britain, which put Blair at 31% approval ratings, which was exactly the same as Bush's approval rating. So an extraordinary coincidence. They're both very unpopular.
Well, Tony Blair has been on his heels since his Labour Party's poor showing in the local elections that were held there earlier this month. And remind us, what led to his party's downfall? I mean, what were the issues that people considered when they went to vote?
Iraq hung over it all, just as it hangs over everything here. And people were very disillusioned with the war. They thought that the war was going badly. They also thought that Blair had told untruths or stretched the truth in getting the British to join with the Americans in invading Iraq. But there's more to it than that. There's a sense that the Labour Party has been in government for too long. There's a sense that they promised to do a lot of things like reforming the National Health Service, which they haven't done. And there's also a sense that they're dominated by what we call in Britain spin.
Of course, we call it the same thing here. But you remind us that although these may be some of the same issues that face the Bush administration, this was an unlikely partnership. I mean, Tony Blair, a liberal who passionately supported the war as a reason for liberal intervention.
They both came from the opposite ends of the political spectrum. Tony Blair from the Labour Party, George Bush from the right wing or the centre-right of the Republican Party. Very different sorts of people, but they did have one thing in common, which is a very strong Christian faith, and also a belief that the power of Western democracies could be used to do good in the world. I mean, as you called it quite rightly, liberal interventionism. So Tony Blair very strangely became the only living British neoconservative, and George Bush became one of the very few American so-called conservatives who really does passionately believe in liberal internationalism, Wilsonianism, essentially.
Well, of course, it's ironic that Blair's party's losses in the recent local elections handed those offices over to conservatives.
Absolutely, and the Conservative Party now, after a desperate period, is doing much, much better and may well take over at the next general election. I mean, it really is a party that's been revived, and it's been revived by a young man called David Cameron, who has many of the qualities that Blair was supposed to have had. 13 years ago, or whenever it was he came to power.
Well, and by the way, you see Blair's party's fall as foreshadowing for Mr. Bush and his party come November. You say, you know, he may be in the same boat, in danger of losing both houses of Congress in the midterm elections here in the U.S. But you also rush to point out that, or your magazine does, that the Democrats here may not be able to take advantage of the president's low popularity in that election. So the president and his party may still maintain a hold on power. But either way, this partnership between Blair and Bush is faltering. Blair is leaving office. And you pose the question, what does this mean for the wider world? Well, what's your answer? What does that mean?
It does pose huge, huge problems in the sense that world foreign policy has really been driven by this unlikely alliance that was forged in the ashes of September the 11th. Between these two people from very different political worlds. And they both agreed on one big thing, which was that we needed to assert Western power in order to deal with the problem of radical Islam, the problem of terrorism, as it were. And this alliance drove foreign policy. I mean, it created a lot of disagreements. It created a lot of people from the French and Germans outwards who disagreed with this policy of liberal interventionism. But this really has been the motor of world foreign policy. And the fact that these people are very weak now, much too weak, for example, I think, to pursue the same policy in Iran that they pursued in Iraq, even if that were possible, does just change the game. It does mean that you have really paralysis at the heart of the global international system, because it's not as though there's any obvious alternative to their policy.
Right. And by the way, your magazine doesn't disagree with either Mr. Blair or Mr. Bush that the war on terrorism and the concern about fundamentalist Islam isn't important. You just feel that the execution was the problem. And now, as you point out, besides Mr. Blair, President Bush's other allies in Europe, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, Jose Aznar in Spain, they've also lost their jobs. So who are the president's new allies?
Well, I mean, the president has been cuddling up, as it were, to Merkel in Germany. And, of course, we have to factor into this the fact that the Blair's opponents and Bush's opponents, people like Schroeder and people like Chirac, are in very, very weak positions. Schroeder because he's out of a job, Chirac because he's, you know, he makes George Bush look like a popular and decisive leader. I mean, Chirac is more than a lame duck. He's a dead duck, really, but he's going to just continue in office. So the problem is that there's a vacuum on both fronts, both in terms of the Blair Bush coalition and also the anti-Blair Bush coalition. There's no real world leadership at the moment. And, of course, we have a resurgent, an aggressive Iran doing what it can to provoke everybody and doing what it can to acquire nuclear weapons, and no clear strategy and no clear leadership to deal with it.
You spoke of Angela Merkel of Germany. Can you point to some other, you know, you said that there may not be any others, but point to some other world leaders that the president might turn to? And I guess, do you see anyone emerging in the way that these two did as a partnership?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I think the one person that one would point to is John Howard in Australia, who is a very impressive man and is in a much stronger position than most other leaders. He's been a very staunch ally in Australia in general. He's been a very staunch ally. I think that we will see some very interesting things happening in the future, either if you get, let's say, a McCain presidency with a continued Republican presidency, or if you get, let's say, a Hillary Clinton presidency, because I think both those people are fairly interventionist and fairly internationalist. And if the Bush, you know, when the Bush era goes, a lot of people in Europe will say, well, we have to rethink our relationship and our instinctive hostility to the United States. And I think either McCain or Hillary Clinton, if that's the choice we're going to be confronted with, will have a real chance to reassert American leadership, but reassert it in a slightly more, let me say, diplomatic way than this administration has done.
Adrian Wooldridge, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist magazine. The cover of their most recent issue shows a picture of Prime Minister Blair and President Bush. The title is Axis of Feeble, The Closing of the Bush-Blair Era. Adrian, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
And still to come today, children's author Lois Lowry, her latest gem is Such Stuff That Dreams Are Made On. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's commencement season, after which college grads commence with the dreaded job search. But at least one study shows that they may not have as much to fear this year. The National Association of Colleges and Employers says that not only are there more jobs available for this year's grads, but that those who are being hired are being offered more money and signing bonuses. Well, joining us with more on the job market is Maria Stein. She's the Director of Career Services at Northeastern University. That's here in Boston. And Maria, we're reading that there's a 14% increase in the number of jobs available. Are you seeing that among the grads you're working with?
We are. There's been definitely more employer activity, recruiting on our campuses, participating in our career fairs, just being more in contact with us, wanting to get access to the seniors that are graduating.
Yeah, and we understand the average starting salary is going up, at least in some fields. Accounting degree graduates, starting salary is up 5.4%.
They're doing well financially.
Yeah, computer engineering grads also up 5.3 to 54,000 for them, to 46 for accounting degree grads. What other fields are you seeing that are doing well?
Marketing students are doing well. Like you said, accounting, the engineering fields overall, the computer and information systems students are doing well. Some of the service industries, I think they're doing better than they have in the past. Nursing, pharmacy, all those kinds of folks are doing quite well these days.
Right. And what fields are lagging? I'm thinking that first in line would probably be, the arts students, the people whose fields are, more creative, shall we say?
Correct. The art students, I think the human services, the education students, the people that go on and work in nonprofits. So the less what you might consider quote-unquote professional kinds of career people.
White collar.
Yes.
Well, then we'd love for you to tell your students to come on over to public radio, but it wouldn't be for the salaries. We understand that corporate recruiters, though, plan to hire 18% more MBAs this year than in 2004. That's according to the Graduate Management Admission Council. And the total compensation with benefits and bonuses is $99,000, up from $77,000 in 2004. That's a big jump.
That is a big jump, but if you recall, we were talking about salaries for accounting students with a bachelor's degree, and they're probably making mid to high 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take a look at the MBA students, that would make sense, because most MBA students these days tend to have 2 to 3 years of experience at least before heading on to an MBA. So they already have experience, plus they're getting their MBA, so they can leverage that kind of salary.
Are you hearing about signing bonuses, people who are getting bonuses just to take a job?
I haven't heard a whole lot of that yet this year. Right before the big dot-com crash, we had a lot of that happening. A lot of employers were offering sign-on bonuses to our students, and $10,000 was not unheard of. I haven't heard as much of that yet this year.
You mentioned the dot-com years. Some are saying this has been the best market for college grads since that time, but we know what happened after that time. So do you caution kids, hey, it may be great now, but make sure you have a cushion because it could change?
I think anybody in career services always speaks with students along those lines. What we're hoping that they realize is that they need to plan ahead, that they need to really stay current in their field and in their training, and keep kind of looking ahead, being proactive and being in charge of their career, and not being a passive participant and hoping that their employer is going to take care of them. Because as we saw in the early 2000s, everything went bust, and people at that point who were making huge amount of money were left unemployed and really were kind of stuck.
Maria, do you have advice for graduating students who haven't found positions yet?
They should definitely make sure that they go see their career services department if they're still close by. Networking, key. Utilize any online job posting service that they're comfortable with, like the monster.com, those kinds of things. But the key is really being out there and staying active. Looking for a job is a full-time job, and they just need to really do some self-analysis and say, what's important to me, and how am I going to approach this?
And when all else fails, become an accountant.
Yeah, if you like numbers.
Maria Stein, Director of Career Services at Northeastern University in Boston, on what looks like a great job market for grads, and their parents are probably relieved to hear it as well. Maria, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Thank you.
In her new book, Newbery Award-winning children's author Lois Lowry spins a fanciful bedtime story with unexpected depths that will seduce readers of all ages. She writes, dreams come from amorphous dream givers who live in special colonies called heaps, where they all sleep in an exhausted pile after a night of delivering dreams.
Every human population has countless such colonies, invisible always of these well-organized, attentive, and hard-working creatures who move silently through the nights at their task. Their task is both simple and at the same time immensely difficult. Through touching, they gather material, memories, colors, words once spoken, hints of sense, and the tiniest fragments of forgotten sound. They collect pieces of the past, of long ago, and of yesterday. They combine these things carefully, creating dreams. Then they insert the dreams as the humans, and sometimes animals, for occasionally they give dreams to pets as well, sleep.
That's Lois Lowry reading from her new book, Gossamer, about the dream givers, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Boy, your previous books, To Remind People, The Giver, Number of the Stars, favorites in our office. But I could not put this down. Where did you come up with this idea?
Oh, that's always the hardest question to answer. I have a farm in Maine, an old farmhouse where I spend time alone with my dog. And I think it was one time there, going to bed one night, thinking about that. And also, there's a bat in this book who flutters through and frightens the woman. And that had happened to me in Maine.
So you've come up with these dream givers, creatures who are assigned people's homes, where they touch their personal items to find these fragments of dreams. They have a gossamer light touch, because if they touch too hard, learn too much, they go over to the dark side?
They get down there in the underbelly, and there always is one.
Then that creates these other creatures. Who are they?
They're called in the book synesthetes. And they're the ones who don't bestow dreams, but instead inflict nightmares. They're the evil creatures of the night, as opposed to these lovely little benevolent creatures.
Right. Because, as we said, when they touch people's items, a shell, a sweater button, when they go through the people's homes and touch these items, they what, linger too long, they touch too hard, and what do they come up with?
Oh, they get too interested and go too deep. And, of course, everything has a dark side. And as a writer, you want to put both sides in the book to create conflict. But the ones with whom my heart lay were, of course, the dream givers.
Right. These are the little translucent characters, including the littlest one, that's her name, and her teacher, thin elderly. And they blow the dreams into the ears of the humans, or in the case of dogs with flop-down ears, they blow
them
through
them. They have to do the nose.
They go through their nose, which is very exhausting for them. It's a lot of effort for them to give us these dreams. Listen to me. I'm going along with this, Lois. But there's also the humans that they're assigned to in the book. There's an elderly woman living with her dog, as you said, that's sort of loosely based on yourself.
Oh, well, yeah, I identified with that woman and her past. She's had tragedy in her past, as all people have by the time they've reached her age.
Do you mind my asking? It may not be something you want to talk about, but what in your past sort of infused, or did you identify
with? Well, the woman in the book refers to, in her past, a soldier, someone she has hoped to marry and who has died in a war. That is not part of my own history, but I lost a son in the military.
Oh, which conflict?
Well, my son was in the, isn't it terrible that we have to say, the first Iraq war, a fighter pilot. He died after the war ended in a training accident.
Oh, in the Gulf War. Well, this woman, your character, takes in a boy, John, who's an angry foster child who comes to live with her. And another character is John's mom, who's trying to get her life in order to get her son back. That's a weighty storyline for a bedtime story.
Well, it is. It's unfortunately too often a true story in the lives of many children, and even those who haven't experienced it are aware of it. And so I needed somebody who needed the dreams, and so I created the very damaged, troubled boy.
I'm reminded, too, that some of your other books, The Giver, Number of the Stars, which is about a family surviving the Holocaust, they go into that territory, the place of nightmares. Some of your books, and you've spoken to this, have even been banned from children's school
reading
lists.
Which
ones were they?
Well, there are many challenges, so that's not the same as a banning, but The Giver receives the most. Number of the Stars has received its first challenge this year, overridden by a school board. But nonetheless, there are people out there who feel that children should only have access to cheerful and uplifting stories. I don't agree with that.
Yeah. Are you worried here because, again, you have a troubled boy who's not always on his best behavior, you know, a mom who seems to have, serious problems, which is why she lost the boy?
Well, I have never anticipated challenges. They take me by surprise every time. I can't believe that people would challenge this book, and yet out there somewhere there might be somebody who feels it's too troubling for his or her child to read. Keep my fingers crossed.
Yeah. At one point, the Dreamgivers, then elderly and littlest one, compete with the Cynesteeds, which are literally steeds. I mean, there's these horses that come through. I mean, it's just an amazing imagery of these things that come to give us nightmares. But they're competing, the good and the bad dream givers, for the mind of John. And there's a point where littlest one, the dream giver, says John's getting weak, and thin elderly tells her, yeah, they, you know, the Cynesteeds are taking the good memories and the fragments. And it just seemed to be some sort of a metaphor or an apt description of what happens to children if you don't nurture them, that they start to lose their good memories.
Well, and he had so little to start with, and so they really need to strengthen him by taking the few good things that he has and making them into dreams and hopes. And, of course, there's the daytime hours, too, in which the woman is very, very kind and patient with the boy. But the evil's always out there waiting to take over.
You mentioned the woman, too, because she plays as active a role in, you know, keeping him from the dark side. But how nice to think that you could just blow a dream into the ear of a troubled child.
Oh, yes, and don't we wish it could really happen that way.
Right. Well, the dream givers become whole. They're, as I said, they're sort of these transparent things, and then littlest one at the end of the book, after working so hard to help John, the real child, she starts to become solid, and she's told that's what happens, you know. And I just thought that was such a wonderful velveteen rabbit kind of moment, you know.
I hadn't thought of that old rabbit, but yeah. You're quite right. You know, all books and all characters in books, whether they're little creatures like this or human characters, need to develop and grow. And so this littlest one is transparent starting out. She's just new to the work, new to herself. And then she begins to fill with wisdom and knowledge. And by the end of the book, she's on her way to maturity.
So Lois Lowry, it's a book about dream givers. And you said you dreamed it up, you know, while trying to, sleep up in Maine. Do you think about them, or is it gone?
Oh, no. Well, I always go on to the next book, but the old ones linger in me. Every one I've written, and I think there have been 30-some, are all there in me. And this is the most recent, of course. And so I suppose not a night goes by that I don't get into bed and think briefly that there might be little translucent creatures out there wishing me well.
Right. Or breathing in your dog's ear or nose.
Nose.
Yeah. I smell movie, as they say. I mean, did you think of it that way? Did you think of it visually?
I always think of books visually. And interestingly, this summer I'm to adapt this to a play. Picture the staging challenges when some creatures are very small and translucent. And that's going to be fun. Movie, I don't know, but could be.
Oh, let's get Steven Spielberg's number. Lois, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Lois Lowry's new book is called Gossamer. We just had to play it. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Fly me high through the starry skies. Maybe to an astral plane.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll speak with two women who